Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 657, titled Targeting the Centers of Finance. This program is being recorded on December 7th of the year 2008. In order to flesh out your understanding, people, please use the Spitfire website, spitfirelist.com. It is, quite simply, the Shangri-La of anti-fascist research. Sorry if that seems egotistical. Credit goes also to those many people who have assisted me with the effort over the years, including the current web folks. But it is an absolutely invaluable, growing, and already enormous resource. Use it, please, because times are getting real, real, real interesting, as they say, in case you hadn't noticed. Now, the title of the broadcast refers to, surprise, Targeting the Centers of Finance. What we're going to be talking about is the recent devastating attack on Mumbai, India. Mumbai basically is the Big Apple of India. It used to be called Bombay. It is not only India's financial center, but something of a cultural center, with the growing Bollywood, as it's called, the Indian film industry being having its epicenter there. And it was attacked in a most devastating and attention-riveting fashion. As we're going to see later, though, right about the same time, there were reports of a planned attack on the New York City subway system. Of course, New York is America's Mumbai, so to speak. That is America's Big Apple. And we're going to be ruminating about some of these things. Notice that the terror front was really quiet during the election, because if terror incidents break out, it tends to weaken George Bush's and the Republicans' claims to being strong on national security. In fact, not only is the Muslim Brotherhood linked to the GOP, but the worldwide Muslim Brotherhood and the underground Reich know that the Republicans are bad for America. They weaken the United States, and they leave almost no aspect of American society unsullied. They've seriously damaged our diplomatic posture abroad, and they have devastated the American economy and trampled on the Constitution. And in so doing, they have, to a large extent, lost, or at least badly set back, a very real war. I don't call it a war on terror, because that's ridiculous. You can't have a war on terror anymore. You can't have a war on poverty. But it is a very real war. And the Islamist, the Islamic fascist forces that are behind a lot of this should at all times be understood as combatants, as literally foot soldiers of a Third Reich gone underground, and also the heralds of the end of the Enlightenment itself. I'll talk more about that in future broadcasts. But targeting the centers of finance, we'll talk about the proposed attack in New York. But you'll notice that the terror front was very quiet during the campaign, because it would have made Bush look weak. In my opinion, it would have made Bush look weak, and it would have made McCain, by extension, look weak. But no sooner does Barack Obama get elected, with the bad jacketing that I've spoken about in 654, 655, and 656. Again, please use the website. But lo and behold, all of a sudden, the terror incidents break out anew. And let's take a look at the group that appears to have been behind the attack on Mumbai. The following is from the Times of India, November 29th, 2008. It's titled, Qaeda in Partnership with Lashkar in India. Lashkar is Lashkar-e-Taiba. Its dateline New Delhi reads in part, terror does leave a calling card. As the enormity of the attack on Mumbai sank in, it seemed like the arrival of Al-Qaeda in India, a version of 9/11 designed to attract a global audience given the scale of violence and the planned targeting of Westerners. With the capture of a terrorist, the actual authors were revealed. It wasn't the Al-Qaeda, but the jihadi credentials were not much less impressive, with Lashkar-e-Taiba named as the suspect. Given the operation's obvious planning, few doubted it was the deadly firm of LETISI in action. Again, that's a reference to the collaboration between the Pakistani Intelligence Service and Lashkar-e-Taiba. Continuing, yet the difference between Lashkar-e-Taiba and Al-Qaeda is not so significant as might once have been the case. In recent years, Lashkar has emerged as not only the single largest pan-Indian terror threat, but also a partner with Al-Qaeda in jihadi battlegrounds like Iraq, Chechnya, and Afghanistan. It has shared training camps and cadre and used Al-Qaeda-Taliban facilities for a jihad against India, skipping down. Aligned with the Al-Hadi sect, Lashkar was founded in 1987 by Saeed, who incidentally was also trained as an engineer like Osama and many other prominent jihadis, and who drew his inspiration from the Egypt-based Muslim Brotherhood, an organization that saw Palestine as an Islamic cause way back in the 1930s. In collaboration with ISI, Lashkar built up an impressive Kashmir portfolio with recruits chiefly drawn from Pakistani Punjabis, Pashtuns, Bangladeshis, Arabs, and Southeast Asians. And the Lashkar is, obviously, and we've talked about Lashkar, although not a great deal in the past, it is a South Asian Muslim Brotherhood affiliate. And one should understand that and also understand the links between the Lashkar and the Pakistani intelligence services. We're going to talk about some of the implications of this attack in terms of global geopolitics. It's actually redundant in terms of geopolitics, but one of the things to understand is that there are indications that the Pakistani intelligence service is working very directly with the jihadis. After the stations that carry these broadcasts have heard, for the record, 656 and 657, I'm going to be rebroadcasting, for the record, 500, an interview with author Sander Hicks, the author of the book The Big Wedding about September 11th, and investigator Alan Duncan. And in that interview, we talk about Stingman Randy Glass, who, while wearing a wire, taped an apparent Pakistani intelligence agent named R.G. Abbas pointing at the Tribeca restaurant to the twin towers of the World Trade Center, saying those towers are coming down. This same individual was working, meaning R.G. Abbas, a Pakistani intelligence agent, was working to obtain nukes for al-Qaeda and related institutions. One of the things significant about that and scary is the fact that when Randy Glass, the Stingman who wore the wire, went to Senator Graham of Florida, who in turn went to the State Department, the word came down that basically the State Department intelligence was aware, and this was in July of 2001, of plans to fly planes into the World Trade Center, but with India and Pakistan eyeball to eyeball in a potential nuclear war, they were frozen. They either felt they couldn't or could not, in fact, have really done anything. Barack Obama now has one hell of a diplomatic imbroglio on his hands. One of the things to think about as people listen to what I'm about to present is, are we going to be seeing something similar? Is the possibility of armed confrontation between two nuclear powers, Pakistan and India, will that freeze the United States diplomatically, or will it freeze intelligence operatives from perhaps interdicting another attack here in the United States or elsewhere, a devastating attack at that? Something to think about, but let's take a look at what Mumbai represents to the jihadis and all others as well. Again, Mumbai, the focal point of the attack, the target of the attack, is India's Big Apple. The following is from the New York Times of November 29th of 2008. This is an op-ed contribution by Sukhetu Mehta. It's titled, What They Hate About Mumbai. My bleeding city, my poor, great, bleeding heart of a city. Why do they go after Mumbai? There's something about this island state that appalls religious extremists, Hindus and Muslims alike. Perhaps because Mumbai stands for lucre, profane dreams, and an indiscriminate openness. Mumbai is all about danda, or transaction. From the street food vendor squatting on a sidewalk, fiercely guarding his little business, to the tycoons in their dreams of acquiring Hollywood, this city understands money and has no guilt about the getting and spending of it. I once asked a Muslim man living in a shack without indoor plumbing what kept him in the city. Mumbai is a golden songbird, he said. It flies quick and sly, and you'll have to work hard to catch it, but if you do, a fabulous fortune will open up for you. The executives who congregated in the Taj Mahal Hotel were chasing this golden songbird. The terrorists wanted to kill the songbird. Just as cinema is a mass dream of the audience, Mumbai is a mass dream of the peoples of South Asia. Bollywood movies are the most popular form of entertainment across the subcontinent. Through them, every Pakistani and Bangladeshi is familiar with the wedding cake architecture of the Taj and the Arc of the Gateway of India, symbols of the city that gives the industry its name. It is no wonder that one of the first things the Taliban did upon entering Kabul was to shut down the Bollywood video rental stores. The Taliban also banned, wouldn't you know it, the keeping of songbirds. Now, the point being that Mumbai is not only a cultural center, it is the financial center of India. It is India's Big Apple. And the attack against Mumbai comes as not only the global economy is weakening, but it comes as India's economy is weakening as a result. And one of the things that I'm not going to have time to go into at great length here, but again, SpitfireList.com, the descriptions are vitally important. There will be information in the descriptions that I don't have time to fit into the main broadcasts. But one of the things to think about is in the eyes of the elements associated with the underground Reich, in the eyes of the elements behind the UNPO, working to break up countries like China, the United States, Russia, by championing the rights of minority peoples, very egalitarian sounding, but in fact a reactionary neo-colonial stance, India and China and the future of the world is in Asia. The Pentagon recently issued a report saying that the transfer of wealth to Asia, primarily to India and China, is of historic proportions. If the 20th century was the American century, the 21st century, barring intervention, is going to be the Asian century. And both India and China are emerging giants. Perhaps superpowers would be too much of a title to use at this point, but soon will be. And that does not sit well with the reactionary forces of the world, including people like the Habsburgs and the others associated with the UNPO. And one of the things that may seem very difficult for people to understand, these same interests see the U.S. the same way. The U.S., China, and India are rebellious colonies. We're escaped slaves, basically, in the eyes of the reactionary elements in Europe. They think back hundreds of years, and they remember when the Indians and the Chinese and others were, quote, bloody wogs, unquote, in the eyes of in the parlance of British reaction. That's a term that doesn't mean much to Americans. It's actually a foul term, but it's what British reactionaries use to describe people they consider to be inferior in India, China, and elsewhere. And so in the eyes of the UNPO and related elements, big countries like India, China, and even the United States are escaped rebellious colonies that need to be punished and broken up. And with India's economy experiencing the slowdown of the global economic turndown, this was a very propitious time for such an attack. New York Times of Thursday, December 4th of 2008 has the following article by Jeremy Kahn. It's datelined Bangalore, India, headlined, "Recession Trickles to India. Echoing clients' woes, outsourcing firms are scaling back." It reads in part, after years of being blamed for job losses in America and elsewhere, India's high-tech companies and outsourcing firms are going through a downturn of their own. The global slowdown is forcing them to reduce hiring, freeze salaries, postpone new investments, and lay off thousands of software programmers and call center operators. The point being that this attack on Mumbai comes at a time when not only is India's economy slowing down, but it comes at a time when India itself is quite vulnerable. And again, bear in mind the fact that this did not take place during the campaign. And bear in mind that the group that appears to have been behind it, Lashkar-e-Taiba, is a Muslim Brotherhood affiliate with the many domestic American connections that I've been talking about, most recently in For the Records 655 and 656. And again, with an eye toward For the Record 500, which is going to be rebroadcast on most of these stations next week, bear in mind that the scary, scary possibility of nuclear war, at least nuclear confrontation, and bear in mind this huge, burgeoning diplomatic imbroglio that Barack Obama's administration has on its doorstep, as if it didn't have enough to deal with already, with the global economy tanking. Op-ed column in the Wall Street Journal of December 3rd of 2008. It's by Bernard-Henri Lévy, a French expert on terrorism, author of a book on Daniel Pearl, a very credible source. And he had a column titled, "Let's Give Pakistan the Attention It Deserves." And it reads in part, "The world is decidedly poorly made. Asif Ali Zardari, widower of Benazir Bhutto and president of Pakistan, must be saying to himself. The French expression, le monde est décidément mal fait, sums things up quite nicely. For it was at the very moment that Mr. Zardari was attempting to modernize his country, to break with the equivocations of the Musharraf years and move forward with a peace process with India for which he took the initiative, that the tragedy of Mumbai occurred. But what's done, unfortunately, is done, and if the authors of the carnage are, as it seems, linked to the Pakistan-based terror group Lashkar-e-Taiba, we can already draw a certain number of appalling and unquestionable conclusions. The Lashkar-e-Taiba is one of the jihadist groups with which I became familiar while working on my book, Who Killed Daniel Pearl? This group is without a doubt based in Pakistan, skipping down. Worse yet, Lashkar-e-Taiba is, as I discovered while researching and reporting my book on Daniel Pearl, a group of which A.Q. Khan, the inventor of Pakistan's atomic bomb, was a longtime friend. Mr. Khan, one may recall, spent a good 15 years trafficking in nuclear secrets with Libya, North Korea, Iran, and perhaps Al-Qaeda before confessing his guilt in early 2004. Later pardoned by General Pervez Musharraf, Mr. Khan remains perfectly free to travel within Pakistan, as he was just admitted this Monday under the protection of the ISI to the most elite hospital in Karachi. So, in addition to being a Muslim Brotherhood affiliate, the Lashkar has strong ties to A.Q. Khan. If, in fact, in any size, shape, form, or manner, this goes nuclear, it is going to be scary indeed. And again, bear in mind my ruminations about the possibility that such a nuclear confrontation could prove diplomatically or perhaps even intelligence-wise paralytic to American interests here. Bear in mind the timing. Again, it was after the campaign. It was as there was a diplomatic initiative underway to cool things down between India and Pakistan. And also bear in mind, too, that Barack Obama has opined publicly that the war in Afghanistan needs to get much more attention in order to defeat the Taliban. And one should note that shortly after that, Ayman al-Zawahiri, the Muslim Brotherhood offshoot al-Qaeda's number two man, went public with that foul address where he termed Barack Obama a house slave and vowed that his efforts to stabilize Afghanistan would not succeed. Keep this in mind, too. If there is war, or even an eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation between Pakistan and India, Pakistani troops now keeping some of the tribal areas that adjoin Afghanistan under, or at least keeping them stable, keeping jihadists from flooding from those tribal areas into Afghanistan, if Pakistan pulls a lot of troops away from there in order to shore up the Indian front, so to speak, that could empower the jihadists in Afghanistan. Something to think about. But again, the links between Lashkar-e-Taiba, the Muslim Brotherhood offshoot that perpetrated the Mumbai attacks, and A.Q. Khan is very scary indeed. So is this. This from the Khaleej Times Online. This is a 2006 article. It's Dateline New Delhi. Pakistan-based rebel group is targeting nuclear facilities by India. This is an AP story. It reads in part, India's defense minister on Monday repeated a warning that Islamic militants based in Pakistan were targeting Indian nuclear, military, and religious sites, a news agency reported. Defense Minister Pranab Mukherjee told lawmakers that militants from Lashkar-e-Taiba, a group believed to have links to al-Qaeda, are planning to carry out some strikes on critical infrastructure items, military targets, and religious places, according to the Press Trust of India. So, again, at least according to the Indian defense minister in the past, they have targeted Indian nuclear facilities. And the possibility of this whole thing going nuclear is about as scary as anything that one could contemplate. But, again, bear in mind some of the scenarios that I've been talking about here. Will this derail the Barack Obama State Department even before it takes office? Interesting that all of this is happening after the campaign, with the Muslim Brotherhood links to the GOP that I've gone into at great length in 654, 655, and 656, as well as elsewhere. I realize this is an intense broadcast, but keep those things in mind, and keep the following in mind, too. This following article is a Time magazine article. It's by Bruce Crumley, Thursday, December 4th of 2008. Were the Mumbai terrorists fueled by coke? Did the jihadists who tore up Mumbai last week rely on party drugs usually associated with Western decadence to stay awake and alert throughout their three-day killing spree? Britain's Telegraph newspaper suggests that they did, citing unidentified officials claiming physical evidence shows the assailants used cocaine and other stimulants to sustain their violent frenzy. And if the notion of self-anointed holy warriors on a coke binge sounds incongruous, the report also maintains that the killers imbibed the psychedelic drug LSD while fighting advanced security forces. We found injections containing traces of cocaine and LSD left behind by the terrorists and later found drugs in their blood, the Telegraph was told by one official whose nationality and relation to the investigation were not specified. This explains why they managed to battle the commandos for over 50 hours with no food or sleep. The hallucinogenic and sensory-distorting effects of LSD make it an unlikely combat drug, even for kamikaze assailants who were, after all, seeking to kill as many people as possible before their own inevitable death. But the suggestion that the Mumbai jihadists may have amped themselves up on stimulants typically forbidden by the strict Salafist brand of Islam strikes some experts as plausible, particularly within the twisted jihadist logic in which holy ends justify impious means. What this reminds me of is Mohammed Atta and company, and in our many conversations with the heroic Daniel Hopsicker, who went right to the belly of the beast there in southern Florida, Mohammed Atta and company were behaving in a very un-Islamic fashion. They were drinking, they were apparently whoring, they were doing drugs, and of course we know, the courtesy of Mr. Hopsicker, as well as an LA Times article from November of 2001, that in addition to Mohammed Atta and his jihadist associates, a lot of Germans were hanging out there and were part of the Mohammed Atta milieu, notably Wolfgang Barringer. I think it is a reasonable question to ask as whether we're looking at something very similar here. If, in fact, those accounts of the Mumbai attackers being drugged out of their gourds are accurate, it certainly is. It reminds us of what Mohammed Atta and company were up to in the United States, and it is perhaps characteristic of some of the Muslim Brotherhood offshoot attacks. Al-Qaeda was one, is an offshoot of Muslim Brotherhood, so is Lashkar-e-Taiba. And we should not lose sight of the fact that Lashkar-e-Taiba is not altogether or elements associated with it are no strangers to the United States. The Daily Times, a Pakistani daily newspaper, has the following story. U.S. court orders deportation of Hafiz Saeed's brother. It's by Khalid Hassan. It's from October 4th of 2008, not too long before the attack. Dateline Washington, it reads, Imam Muhammad Massoud, brother of Hafiz Muhammad Saeed, founder of the band Lashkar-e-Taiba, was ordered deported by a Boston, Massachusetts court on Thursday on immigration violation charge. And skipping down, Imam Massoud came to the U.S. in 1987 under a special visa for exchange students. Wonder if he had anything to do with the Muslim Student Association, by way of perhaps providing just a bit of comic relief. It's not really very funny, but perhaps it's funny in the Nietzschean sense of a joke as the epigram on the death of a feeling. Guess who some elements in Pakistan are blaming? Guess on whom they're blaming the attacks. Can you guess? The Times of India has the following story. December 2nd, 2008. This is Dateline New Delhi and reads in part as follows. It's headlined, Pakistan TV channel says 2611, that's the November 26th attack, hatched by, hold on to your hats, Hindu Zionists. Mumbai's 2611 was actually a plan hatched by Hindu Zionists and Western Zionists, including the Mossad, said a self-styled Pakistan security expert on a Pakistan news television show uploaded on www.hotclicks.com. Well, no doubt. Of course, the Mossad has to be in there, but Hindu Zionists. The only thing that's more far out that I can think of off the top of my head, there is a publication, the title of which escapes me off the top of my head, but it basically, it pines for the Confederacy. It is an overt neo-Confederate, white supremacist slash fascist slash Nazi publication. By the way, something also viewed with favor by some of the elements of the so-called 911 truth movement, that same ultra-reactionary publication, but they had a guest column, an op-ed column by a Japanese fascist who blamed Japan's problems on what he claimed was a successful gambit in the mid-19th century in which international Zionism substituted secret Jews for Japan's imperial family. And that ever since the mid-19th century, the Japanese imperial family, the Japanese royal family, were actually, including the Emperor of Japan, were actually closet Jews, and that's what caused all of Japan's problems. You got that? Strange. They don't look Jewish. But again, Pakistan TV channel blaming the attacks on Hindu Zionists. Sounds like Pacifica Radio to me. Whether or not there is any connection whatsoever, and I'm not saying there is, but I wonder, given some of the overt Nazi and BND links to some of these jihadist elements, and again, the jihadists, the Muslim Brotherhood, should be understood as foot soldiers of a Third Reich gone underground. They don't have enough of their own soldiers. Too many of them died in two world wars, so they're using others. There's more to it than that. But there was another incident of apparent Islamist terror. This one didn't get a lot of publicity, wasn't very big. But in Kosovo, which has a Muslim ethnic Albanian majority, and the Kosovo Liberation Army being descended from, among other institutions, the 21st Waffen-SS Division, the Skanderbeg Division, one of three Balkan Muslim Waffen-SS divisions put together by the Grand Mufti. There was a firebomb attack at EU headquarters that was conducted just a few days after the Kosovo-Albanian majority, Muslim, rejected an agreement by the UN and Serbia on the deployment of a much-delayed EU police and justice mission called ULEX. And three Germans got held in this particular attack. BBC News has the following from November 23rd of 2008. Germans held in Kosovo over blast. A Kosovan judge has ordered three Germans suspected of throwing an explosive device at the EU headquarters in Pristina to be held for 30 days. The three deny involvement in the attacks of 14th of November, saying they were detained while investigating it themselves. Windows in the glass-fronted building were shattered, but nobody was hurt. German and Kosovo media report that the men are German intelligence agents, but officials in Berlin refuse to comment. Lawyers for the detainees say the prosecution is seeking terrorism charges that carry a maximum 20-year sentence. So were they just in fact investigating as they claim, or was there more to it? For the record, 656, we took a look at Mr. Farhan, who was attempting to reform the University of Michigan at Dearborn chapter of the Muslim Student Association, a Muslim Brotherhood offshoot. The imam of that very same institution was associated with Hizb ut-Tahrir, an Islamist/Al-Qaeda affiliate that works with the German NPD, the top German neo-Nazi party in Germany. So, again, there may be no connection whatsoever, but I do think it's worth looking at some of these things to attempt to ferret out whatever patterns might actually be there. And speaking of patterns, just before India's Big Apple, Mumbai, was attacked, there was a threat against America's Big Apple as well. The following is from Yahoo News of Wednesday, November 26th of 2008. New York subway terror threat emerges on busy travel day at State Line, New York, and reads in part, "Police bolstered security in subways and trains Wednesday after the government warned that Al-Qaeda suicide bombers were contemplating an attack on New York's mass transit systems during the holiday season." An internal memo obtained by the Associated Press says the FBI has received plausible but unsubstantiated report that Al-Qaeda terrorists in late September may have discussed attacking the subway system. There have been reports like this for quite some time, but I wonder why this emerged right at this time, after the election and just before the attacks on Mumbai. Were we meant to create a psychological association between the very real attack on India's Big Apple and the alleged threats against ours? Food for thought and grounds for further research, as I call it. Please use the SpitfireList.com website. If this broadcast sounds a little confusing or a little bit too much for to drink at one sitting, please use the website, because not only is each program turned into an article-length description, but there's often information which I did not have time to get into the broadcast, and we are all out of time in this broadcast. This concludes For the Record program number 657, Targeting the Centers of Finance. This is being recorded on December 7th of the year 2008, and my name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.